Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, merchandise, an archive of past episodes and information on how you can help keep this podcast running. That's fyrgen.com. Greetings, listeners of the Fergan. You're back with me, Dan Capp, and this week, this episode, I'm joined by my good friend Dave Martell, and many of you will know, hopefully all of you will know who he is. He's the proprietor of the Bizarchives, kind of short story compendium publisher. He is the one half of the Culture Dads podcast, and he also has the Bog YouTube channel. So, Dave, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing wonderful, Mr. Dan. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, it's always good to speak with you. And this is the second time that you've featured on the Fergan podcast. And the reason that I wanted to get Dave on for this is very specific. Dave has a very kind of interesting, fascinating, you know, at times entertaining, at times terrifying kind of concept and theory, which I'll let him introduce. But this is something that I feel a lot of listeners of this podcast would be interested in, you know, especially those of you who are familiar with the work of like Ted Kaczynski and stuff like that. So the concept is called the Mechanurge. And yeah, I'll just hand it over to Dave to explain what this is about. And we're going to just kind of talk about the ramifications of this on our world as it is, maybe what it means for the future, whether there is really any kind of, I don't know, truth or threat in this concept, or, you know, it ties into lots of other stuff which we're going to get into. So, yeah, Dave, if you wouldn't mind, just let us know what this is all about.
Okay, so first of all, this is somewhat of an abstract theory. It's kind of cobbled together from a bunch of observations that I've made over the years, various books that I read. I really hate when people talk about theories, or when I talk about, or anybody talks about theories, and they say, okay, well, you have to read these books before you understand it. I'm going to try to completely avoid that. However, you guys out there that really think that this theory is fascinating, a few books that I would recommend. Obviously, he mentioned Ted Kaczynski, was a Industrial Society and Its Future. Jacques Ellul has two books, with Jacques Ellul very greatly influenced Ted Kaczynski. He's got two books. One of them is Propaganda. Another one is called The Technological Society. And then finally, I would recommend, this is one, if you want to skip all those books, because you know, Ted Kaczynski and Jacques Ellul make some somewhat problematic presuppositions in their books that don't really jive with, you know, us in these spheres and how we understand the world and our belt and shong. So I would recommend, if you want to skip those, you want to do a whole one that kind of sums up a lot of this really well and in different ways than I do, is a fellow named Dmitry Orlov. And he has a really great book called Shrinking the Technosphere. And this thing that we're talking about, you know, Jacques Ellul called it the Technological Society. Ted Kaczynski called it Industrial Society. And then Dmitry Orlov calls it the technosphere. And I call this thing the Mechanurge, because I take it another step further, right? Dmitry Orlov did something where he separated from those two previous guys and other Luddite thinkers in that he applied will to it. He recognized that this entity has will. Now, when I take a look at this understanding of will and this entity, the technosphere having will, I very much look at it from a very heathen framework, an understanding of immanent cosmology and all of these immanential processes that we understand as heathens. So let's take a step back and look at what is the Mechanurge, and then we're going to lay down a couple definitions before we really go into it. The Mechanurge, like the previous Luddite thinkers that I mentioned, is the amalgamation of technology, organizing itself as an emergent system and developing will, not at the behest of anything other than itself and its motivation to replicate itself, right? So let's take a couple definitions, right? I mentioned emergent systems. Emergent system is something that is very necessary to understanding the not just how technology works, but how reality works. Emergent systems are effectively systems that emerge into other systems and go on and on and on, expand out. And these are cooperating elements that cooperate together and eventually expand outward, right? So, for example, the way that I describe this is... emergent systems of multiplicity would be like you have these amino acids, right? Amino acids begin to cooperate together. The amino acids aren't necessarily conscious because consciousness is very strictly a human trait. Only humans have consciousness. Only humans really have speech. And this comes from consciousness. However, despite not having true consciousness, amino acids begin to cooperate. And this makes single cell organisms. Single cell organisms begin to cooperate, and these single cell organisms become multi-cell organisms, things like amoebas, forth. These multi-cell organisms cooperate together to create bigger organisms, so on and so forth, blah, 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 blah. And then these great systems of multiplicities can go into create mammals and animals and fish and blah, blah, blah. And like all of those things go together to create all of our insides that all cooperate together, all of these different microbiomes and various things that cooperate together, create the emergent system that is like the human body, which is a multiplicity. And then the humans and human bodies organize together into families, families into communities, communities into nations, and nations into, so on and so forth, forever and ever, ad infinitum, until you get all of the gigantic universe. So this is what an emergent system is. And emergent systems operate based on the pressures that is put upon them by the greater immanential rules of reality, things like fate, things like, you could even put it in a very material sense and say things like gravity, et cetera, et cetera.
And sorry to interrupt you there, but we could kind of refer to that as what you've described there is essentially Dharma, as I understand it.
Or Urlog.
Yeah, of course. It's natural order, basically. It's like, it's the kind of the code of this material reality, the laws that are laid down, as you know, and obviously Orlog is directly related to the idea of law.
Yes. So, emergent systems are very much one of the codes, one of the elements of Urlog, which organizes all of reality, all of immanent reality. So, when you look at this law of emergent systems of Urlog, to think that Urlog would not apply to machines and inanimate objects when it previously already applies itself to inanimate objects, things that are inanimate, i.e. amino acids, things like various elements come together and break apart and create greater things all of the time, right? If they didn't, we wouldn't have water, we wouldn't have gasoline, we wouldn't have oxygen, you know what I mean? We wouldn't have reality. We wouldn't have material reality if emergent systems didn't apply to inanimate things all of the time.
Right.
So
yeah,
in my opinion, it is kind of silly to think that these things that we create that become effectively synthetic hyper environments are that these laws don't apply to them, right? Why would our technosphere not operate in the same thing? We talked about this before when we were talking about hyperreality and everything like that. And that's another topic, right? The entities that could possibly be swimming around in hyperreality and all this kind of stuff. So yeah. Fast forward a little bit before I keep rambling. Is the Mechanurge is effectively the totality of all emergent systems of cooperating elements of technology that we have created, and it is now working at its own behest, detached from human influence. And that is what we're dealing with now. And we see this, and you know, a lot of people mistake a lot of things that are happening in reality in our current time as this grand master plan of humans, right? And some of it is, and I would certainly agree that some of it is. However, I find it really hard to believe that everything that seems to be happening in lockstep with one another, with a similar thrust and direction, is being puppeted by like a handful of human beings. I just don't see that human beings are smart enough to control this. Here's an example, right? We see like we look at the can I say the COVID word here? Or is it?
Yeah,
is
that of course. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so we see the COVID thing, right? And it's very much, you know, yeah, I believe, and I'm sure a lot of listeners believe that it was either purposely or maybe accidentally released by from a lab, but it was most certainly created using technology. It is not a natural virus. Well, this is not the only virus that has been released. That was put out there. This is pretty spooky stuff. Right now, where I live, in a lot of the northern parts of the United States, we are seeing what is called CWD. CWD is chronic wasting disease, and it is a disease that is right now completely exterminating the entirety of the white-tailed deer and other deer populations. And this is also includes animals like elk and moose and similar mammals. And what this disease was a lab in, I believe it was the late 60s or the 70s, in Colorado, was studying scabies that appears in sheep. Now, this disease also can appear in bovine, and it's called mad cow disease. Those of you guys over in Europe probably remember the mad cow disease outbreak that you guys had over there. Yeah, so, And luckily, those cows that contracted this disease were domesticated. They were terminated, right? They just killed all the cows that had it, got rid of them, and that was it. Well, the problem with chronic wasting disease is that when they were studying it with the sheep, they somehow got it to transmit to white-tailed deer that they had in captivity. So they lost their funding, and somehow the deer escaped. They got released. Nobody really knows. And they went out into the animal population, thus spreading this very, very horrible disease. So what this disease does is it changes the body to begin releasing what are called folded proteins. It is literally just a ticker, a clock that goes off that says you now have 2 years to live and your body is going to deteriorate and you are going to die. The deer population now, it has reached, this is from Colorado, it has reached Pennsylvania, which is, you know, we're talking three United Kingdoms away, right? It's like a long, long distance. And this is how much of the deer population is affected. So what is happening now, hunters are stopping hunting because what they have to do to ensure that they don't get contaminated meat, it's so pervasive that when they kill a deer, they cut the head off and they put it in these collection bins. And the state authorities or whatever go around, collect the heads, and they give it a test. And then 2 weeks later, they tell the hunter whether it's good or bad. And a lot of these hunters are finding that they shoot 2, 3, 4 deer, and it's bad. So it's like the majority of these deer are carrying this disease. It gets spread from saliva, feces, urine, doe that give birth to baby deer. It gets transmitted that way. It is completely just wiping out deer population. They tried to get rid of it. They tried to burn it. But what happens is with this disease is it gets released by these things called prions, and these prions get spread, right? This is a completely unnatural, bizarre disease. So these prions get released. They get the plants can consume them, and it becomes part of plants. They tried to burn this out when they found out this disease was going on. They burnt a huge population of they pretty much just set fire to this region that was contaminated. What happened is it spread it. The fire cannot kill the prions. In fact, it made them multiply and spread even further. This thing is a permanent thing that survives winters. It cannot be stopped. So this is something that we're seeing all over the place. Avian flu. We're seeing just like all of this, these horrendous results of technology and manipulating diseases and the spread of plastics and polymer. You know, they found traces of polymer at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Like, these things are spreading out and out and out. So how is it that all of these diseases over the last, you know, 80 years or 100 years or whatever, diseases, chemicals, et cetera, are spreading out to wipe out the Earth? And it's somehow some grand master plan to do this. Now, this is a theory that I have. This is going to be very unpopular. Is that that this is this the elites that are doing this, pushing us to live in pods and eat bugs, may not be doing it to have control. Maybe doing it as damage control. Like, they're trying to control the damage that they see is coming. That it's very possible that in our lifetime, much of the animal population on planet Earth will be wiped out and that we will have nothing to eat. So they're trying to curb the grand global chaos by tricking us into eating bugs and everything like that. So how does this go back to the Mechanurge? It is, in my view, impossible for all of these things to all occur at the same time, creating all of this kind of damage. The Mechanurge is this is the emergent system of technology that goes beyond and pretty much has reached into all facets of planet Earth. It is reassigning and reorganizing the genetic makeup of not just animals and wiping out animals that are not efficient, but is also doing it to us, right? A lot of this kind of stuff, when we talk about like leaving technological society, leaving the technosphere and escaping into the woods and going in, which is a beautiful, wonderful thing. It's just, it's like not beyond the reach of the technosphere. The technosphere has already poisoned everything. We're like 100 years late. Not only that, but our genetics have changed drastically. And this is the will of the technosphere, right? So my summation is that, and then there's way more examples as well. My summation is that this technosphere has will, and it could very possibly, you know, develop some sort of consciousness based on all of our collective belief in it, our use of it. So it's like it's a big, gigantic master thing, right?
Okay, man, Dave, you promised me that you weren't going to take it to the darkest possible place like immediately, but you did.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's I'm going to try and kind of play the role of simpleton here, because there's an enormous amount to unpack in what you just said. You know, this is obviously a new concept to most of the people listening to this. And, you know, presumably the name that you've given this Mechanurge, that's derived from the Platonic concept of the Demiurge.
Yeah.
Which is the creator of or the craftsman or whatever of the material realm, which some Gnostics purportedly viewed as
evil.
As evil. Yeah. They, you know, there is this perception of the Gnostics as being, you know, a certain of the Gnostics as viewing the material realm as kind of a prison, you know, a material prison. That's an oversimplification and in many ways a misrepresentation, but I'm not going to get into that. Anyone who's interested in that might want to check out my conversation with John Lamb Lash. But anyway, that is the concept of the Demiurge is nevertheless rightfully the idea of the material creator. So your idea of the Mechanurge is basically the idea that this Demiurge is actually a kind of post-industrial technological behemoth that's kind of taken control of the material realm. That's where you got it from, right?
Yeah, and I believe that its end goal is to collapse and destroy what the previous creation was, and to build its own, to be a new like Demiurge. Now, I don't believe in the Demiurge previously. That's not in my belief system. But I use that term to describe, because I very much view that the Mechanurge is using us as reproductive organs to help replicate itself until it doesn't need us anymore. And then it will create this new dawn of technological society of like effectively either humanless or populated by inhuman creatures that will, you know, it is going to birth its own golden future, its own golden age where technology reigns supreme.
Right. And I think a question that a lot of people might have is, how does this differ from AI? You know, we have this, there's been this kind of fear-mongering in recent years, in recent decades, you know, going back to the Terminator films and beyond, about the prospect of, you know, artificial intelligence taking over, of kind of robotics taking over the society in the world. And obviously that's depicted in The Matrix and stuff like that, and taken to its logical conclusion. I mean, what's you know, I'd like your take on this as well, but what strikes me in what you just described, especially when you're talking about the prions and these kind of artificial diseases which might be out there, when we speak about AI, we're really only talking about software. We're only talking about this spread of this kind of this artificial intelligence within existing hardware as this kind of software virus. But what you just described is like, it seems that this this concept of the Mechanurge has expanded to include physical objects as well, you know, the material realm as well, not just kind of software that is spread throughout the globe, but actual viruses and these kind of artificial, you know, miniature or even microscopic entities, right?
Yeah. So the Mechanurge could continue its growth without AI ever truly coming to fruition. The problem with artificial intelligence and a lot of people's understanding of it is they get a lot of it from sci-fi, from science fiction, which is, you know, I love sci-fi, I publish sci-fi. But the bottom line is that the conceptualization of artificial intelligence that people fear is not really the case. They think that it's going to wake up and be like, oh, please, please teach me how to love, teach me how to dream. And it's like, that's not going to be what it's like. It's a completely inhuman thing. The Mechanurge has will in the same way an amoeba has will. It mindlessly expands and consumes and moves its cilia. It's an unthinking system that has developed it will, right? So when we talk about AI, AI is like already now. People have been kind of like outraging recently about AI art, and I have a little bit to say about that. But artificial intelligence, there is machine learning, right? The way that artificial intelligence works is it's a simulacra of how the human brain works, at least on a material level, right? Machine learning, artificial intelligence is effectively a series of nodes of information that interconnect to come together to create the best possible outcome for a problem. It is a problem solving algorithm using many, many, many nodes of information. The human brain works in a very similar way, except instead of nodes of information, it is using past experiences or learned experiences, right? So like, you know, when you're a kid, you burnt your hand. You've heard that fire is dangerous. So you walk up and you see a pipe that is red hot. You're like, okay, well, that's hot. That burns. I don't want to touch that because it's a danger to me. That is how the brain works. And that is how, at least on a material level, and that is how neural networks work, i.e. AI. It's why they're called neural networks, because they're designed like a brain, right? The way the brain works. So artificial intelligence is never, ever going to be like how human beings are. It can't be. It is something that is, you know, we are a creation of the gods, right? We are in their, they made us in their image. They gave us soul. They gave us und. They gave us odor, right? They gave us all the gifts that make us unique. That is why there's not a single animal on the planet that can do what we do and talk how we talk and think how we think. Machines will never be able to do that. However, they will be become very, very good at simulating it and simulating it in a way that can trick us. And this is some of the spooky stuff that, that could be coming up in regards to artificial intelligence and machine learning. And this is what scares me about it is, very soon they will be able to create holograms. I mean, holograms are already good. Like everybody can go on YouTube and look at holograms and see how crazy they look. They're getting very good at voice replication. They'll be able to replicate voices. They now, like, because all of us are on the internet so much using our phones, they can copy and mimic our syntax and how we talk and our quirks and everything. So what is going to appear, I believe we're going to see this in our lifetimes and probably in the next few decades, is that they will be able to create AI versions of people that pass away, right? They are going to give this illusion of immortality to people, right? Grandma passes away to help you deal with the grief. You will go and order an AI grandma. It looks like grandma because it models the grandma after all of her pictures on the internet. It will use all of her texts, all of her private messages, everything, all of her phone calls to replicate her voice, her syntax, everything, the way that she talks. And you will effectively get what appears to you to be grandma still alive. And over time, what this is going to do is this is going to distort our understanding of mortality. And yeah, we will start to think, well, people don't really die. We're not going to really understand mortality anymore. And and then there's gene editing and like all this kind of stuff going together is pretty spooky stuff. So that's my take on AI, is that AI right now is a problem, but it's not like going to like wake up like Skynet and like start talking to us and stuff like that, like Terminator.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, firstly, I have to say that what you've just described there about returning dead relatives is precisely the plot of an episode of Black Mirror. Did you ever see that?
I never saw all of it. I saw like the first few episodes.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Well, just by chance, then you have hit upon the plot of one of the episodes that is exactly what one of them is about. And yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, Black Mirror is a British I think it's kind of like become like an international thing, but it started as a British TV series written by a British guy and it's all of the episodes are about this kind of mostly dystopian technological future, and they depict things like this. And there was one very famous episode starring Ron Howard's daughter, I think it was, about the social credit system. And this was years ago that this episode came out, and also years ago that the episode with restoring, you know, the kind of likeness of dead relatives based on their phone conversations, their text messages, their emails, and photos of them and everything. So yeah, I can't dispute that that's something that they might try and do at some point, or perhaps, you know, this mechanage. But the AI thing, yeah, so I guess what you're saying with that is that AI doesn't have a purpose beyond human purpose. It doesn't have a frame of reference beyond human frame of reference, whereas the mechanage has its own independent purpose and its own independent kind of foundation. Is that kind of what you're getting at there?
Yeah, that AI. Well, what was I going to say? So AI, the problem with AI isn't going to be AI itself. It's going to be how we evolve to behave living beside it.
Right.
That is going to be the problem. And this is effectively like part of the whole mechanerd. You got to think of the mechanerd is not like an entity sitting on a throne somewhere puppeting everything. It is an abstract cooperation of just like endless amounts of emergent systems of technology, all kind of like indirectly working in cooperation. So like, you know, like when I say this, people are like, oh, so my toaster is working with my computer, is working with my cell phone, working with my lawnmower. Yeah, and effectively, yes, right? It would be like asking, so this rock works with the river down the street, working with the oxygen in the air, working with the mountains on the other side of the world? Not directly, but yeah, they are part of a system. right? Everything is part of a system. Everything is part of a collective. And to think that technology is not a collective, and that this technosphere that we live in, which is a hyper environment within the biosphere, within the organic environment, is not at the mercy of the same laws that shaped our organic organic reality, is just, like, to me, it's silly to think that just because we made it, that the laws that govern and order all things, like, it's like exempt. You know what I mean?
So it's kind of like a competing ecosystem almost. It's like it's competing with the natural order, which we are all familiar with.
Yeah. In fact, I would argue that for the last two, three, four generations, we have been born within the technosphere. We are not familiar. The biosphere is like a place where we go vacation. It's effectively an alien environment. You know, the overwhelming majority, especially in the West and especially in industrialized nations, the overwhelming majority of people are not comfortable. Like, you couldn't just throw them in the woods and they'll be comfortable in that home. That's not normal for them. That's like, let's go on vacation. Let's go do something dangerous. Let's go, you know, let's go out into this foreign space, this unfamiliar space, right? And people, you know, I might be a little cynical, a little too self-critical, self-aware, but I don't know anybody, even people that I know. I grew up in Pennsylvania. This is the capital of deer hunters and outdoorsmen. Everybody I grew up with, my high school, for the first day of deer season, kids would be able to, we didn't have school, right? That's the kind of environment that I grew up in. And even in that environment, I don't know anybody that I think would, is like natural in the biosphere. Everybody is used to air conditioning. Everybody is used to climate control. Everybody is used to artificial light and wall-to-wall carpet. Nobody is used to the biosphere. So we have been for generations bred to live here. We have habituated.
That is a bleak diagnosis, but I can't fault it. You're absolutely right. I mean, I was fortunate enough today to have a visit from my good friend Whityard, which some of the listeners might be familiar with. He's appeared on the Fergan podcast as well a couple of times. He's also a mutual friend of mine and Dave's. And we had a discussion as I was in the car with him earlier. And we came upon the, well, we both agreed, and it's, you know, this won't be a new concept to Dave or many of you, but what we kind of have is like an artificial veneer on top of the natural realm. You know, and as I said to Whityard as well, the legal system does the same thing. That's an artificial system of values and customs that's put upon natural law. And we have that as well with things like, you know, everything being electronic, with climate control and air conditioning and I guess you could even say to an extent clothing and things like that. You know, we... I'm just going to drop in there. There's a very famous among kind of conspiracy theorists. There's a famous presentation by a guy called Lloyd Pye from years and years ago, and he basically argues that mankind was not adapted to survive in this environment. You know, when you think about it, why are we the only animal on this planet that needs clothing to survive within our environment? You know, and in most of the world, humans need to wear clothing to survive within the environment. Why were we not evolved to survive within that environment without clothing, for example? So, you know, you can take it to that extreme and say that even clothing is kind of an artificial veneer on top of what should be the biosphere, as Dave calls it, the natural realm. So, yeah, we have this, we do live in this artificial world because it's a post-industrial age where almost everything that we live with is kind of in spite of nature rather than working in conjunction with it, right? We're always fighting against the harshness of nature, of the inconveniences of nature. We've created all of these things which help us to avoid living within the natural realm as other animals do, you know? So, yeah, I just wanted to drop that in there and see what you think of that, Dave.
No, I agree with all that. Why do we need shoes? You know what I mean? Like if I go out, yeah, I'll go walk around in my yard with no shoes. I might even take a little walk down to the creek or whatever, barefoot or in my sandals or whatever. But if you like drop me off in the woods, the first thing I would probably do is try to make a pair of shoes. You know what I mean? That's yeah. What other creature needs a pair of shoes?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And this is, there was some point that we didn't need shoes, but that point that we didn't need shoes was so far away. That if we go back to our ancestors that didn't need shoes, we would look at them and be like, you're not really a human.
Mm.
You know what I mean? They wouldn't look human to us. They would look ape-like. They probably would, you know, we're talking Neanderthals or Cro-Magnon or, Denisovans or whatever, right? Whatever was living back then that didn't need shoes. We would look at them and be like, you're not like us. You are something primitive. Right.
Yeah.
So this idea that our natural, we just need to like go outside and we'll be better. And, you know, I'm not saying you shouldn't go outside. I'm not saying that nature is bad. I'm not saying anything, but what I'm saying is we need to look in the mirror and realize what we are. And, the gravity of what is coming. Right. Because here's the deal is that nowhere ever in history. And history is a wonderful example for anything. If you can look back in history and say, okay, this happened here, this happened here, then it's probably something feasible. Never in history has a civilization turned away, shut down, or like rolled back technology. The only time that possibly happened is if there was a great collapse. And what did the first thing people do when they got their feet back underneath them is recreate that technology or try to. Once the cat's out of the bag, it can't go back in. So what I propose with the Mechanurge is we have to understand that whether it is the Mechanurge, the way I describe it, or it's just technology in general, but we need to figure out how to go forward and kind of leave behind these like romantic copes about going back to living in cottages and everything like that. Because what is ahead of us is spooky, you know what I mean? So
right, yeah,
that's what I'm talking about.
So I think that probably leads quite well onto something that you and I agreed to discuss, which is this whole idea of AI art and music. Mm-hmm. And you said that you had a take on this which might not prove to be, I'm not going to say popular, but not be very comfortable for many listeners to hear. And I don't even know what Dave is going to say about this. So, yeah, what do you think about AI art and music? You know, do you think it's a real threat to us, or do you think that there's some worth to it, or what?
Well, so how can I word this without coming out? AI art is pretty much if we're talking about the threats to our humanity from the side of technology, AI art is a nothing burger. It really is like it will not change our lives in the way that many other. You want to talk about AI art, man? There's AI out there that is doing crazy things that is going to really change how we do things. We can talk about AI selection of gene editing, which goes down a really dark path. But the bottom line is that AI art, as it stands right now, is a boon for guys like me and you, Mr. Dan, because we are artists. We create art that is not visual art. Visual art for us is an advertisement, right? The visual art that you put on your album covers is not really your album. That is an advertisement to get people's attention to buy the album. For me, a book cover is an advertisement for what's in the book. The art that I create is the written word, right? So for guys like us, where art is a very, very expensive thing. It's cheaper, it's faster than hiring an illustrator, right? So I will, if I really, really wanted to, with the help of AI art, I could skip artists and spit out books like every day. And like really, you know what I mean? I could really put some stuff out on the market, right? So yeah. Economically, it is a boon for us.
Well, I'm going to have to disagree with that, because I am, as well as being a musician, the majority of my day job is as a graphic designer.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, AI art surely poses a threat, because, you know, especially smaller businesses who are on budgets, if they, you know, for example, if there's a band out there and they want an album cover and they've only got, you know, like a couple of $100 to spend on it, you know, they know that they're not going to get some masterpiece, which is considered, you know, one of the greatest, most creative artistic album covers of all time, but they just need something which is going to look striking, represent their music, you know, to a reasonable extent, catch people's attention, get them to check out the record. Are they going to go to a free AI art website, type in whatever they want, you know, whatever wording they want to create the imagery which is going to suit their album art, and do that for free? Or are they going to come to someone like me and pay a few $100 to do it? You know, it's increasingly, much like people moving towards streaming music for free, it's going to be the latter. You know, they're going to go straight to AI art. So yeah, that's a threat. But also, Dave, you know, you're a writer. You know, you write books, short stories and poems. You're a musician too. You know, I'm a musician. I've written a short story too. You know, what happens when, because I've not had any experience of this yet, but I'm hearing that AI music is kind of the next thing coming along. So if you're creating like an advert for, I don't know, like printers or something, whatever, you know, you're a company and you want to create an advert which is going to feature on YouTube, you know, halfway in, you know, through someone's video for the printers that you sell, and you need, you know, just some simple kind of shitty soundtrack for that, just some really simple music that's going to kind of suit the advert. No longer are you going to go and pay someone, you know, a reasonable sum of money to create that for you. You're going to go to AI music. You're going to type in what you want, and it's going to spit out some kind of elevator music for you. It's probably, well, I already know. I mean, I get emails from, you know, scammers or people who basically might as well be scammers saying, have you thought about getting AI to write your blog articles? So AI literature is going to become a real thing as well. So do you not think that those things are a threat? AI music and AI literature?
Well, taking a step back to art, this is going to be the white pill for some of the guys out there that are artists. AI art is, in my opinion, probably, at least not in the foreseeable future, going to be able to replace high-level skilled artists, the guys that can really, really paint beautiful things, create really, you know, use symbolism, and like guys that really put their heart and soul in and are high-level skill. So what we're going to see, and this is something that is going to be beneficial for these guys, AI art is going to chop off the lousy artists. It's going to chop off the guys that, we're going to talk about the industry for a second when it comes to art. I am somebody, and for people that before they go, oh, you use AI art or blah, 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 blah. I spend thousands of dollars every year paying artists. Thousands of dollars. I put food on their table. I hire them. So people out there that might not like what I'm talking about, it when you guys start spending thousands of dollars a year hiring artists and putting food on their table, then we can start talking about who's ethically right or wrong, right? So that's something. But when it comes to hiring these artists, the high level artists will always, at least for the foreseeable future, have a job, because computers cannot understand things like symbolism. They cannot produce high level human art. What we've been dealing with, and I'm gonna tell you guys like what it's like dealing with artists, right? First of all, AI machinery has been replacing craftsmen for years and years and years and years, right? There was no outrage when the photocopiers got replaced by scanners. There was no outrage when translators were replaced. There was no outrage when bookbinders were replaced. Artists and craftsmen have been, and you know, illustration is not some magical thing. It is a craft. It is a craft just like anything else. Nobody had anything to say when that was going on. But now that it's in the realm of illustrators, it's now this big moral outrage. Here's the thing with slippery slopes. Once you're sliding halfway down the slope, you can't hop off. It's just the way that it is. Once the train has left the station, it's left the station. So this is the direction that we're going, whether it's right or wrong. I am a practically minded person. So I'm saying this is where we're going. Let's try to use it as ethically as possible and as financially beneficial as possible, because the people we're competing against are going to use it.
Yeah, it does feel like if you want to get off of that slippery slope, then your only choice is to, and this is going to sound pretty dark, but your only choice is to check out, you know. And I don't necessarily mean suicide, but I mean literally check out of society altogether. You can't have one, you can't really have one foot in and one foot out, because by doing that, all that you're doing is, and I realize as I say this, that I am someone who does try to do that. You know, I'm someone who refuses to have a smartphone and stuff like that. And so maybe in that sense, I'm kind of hypocritical, but I do agree with you that, you know, you're just inconveniencing yourself if you try to kind of stop that slippery slope, if you try to kind of scrabble your way back to the top, or, you know, you're trying to have one foot in and one foot out. You're not going to be able to compete with everyone who's just riding that tiger. You know, with everyone who is living in time and kind of making the most of the circumstances that are given to us. But at the same time, you're inconveniencing yourself to, you know, a partial degree. And yeah, maybe I'm just kind of like a stubborn old dinosaur in doing that. And I do realize that I only make my life more difficult by doing it. It's kind of more like a kind of spiritual, protest, I guess, I would consider it. And it's just me being, you know,
completely cool. Yeah, I respect it. I'm not out here. I don't judge nobody with how, because this is a complicated issue. It's got gray areas as far as the ethics go. So I don't, people that don't like AI art or don't like smartphones, I will never get on somebody that refuses to use or do these things or whatever. It's a gray territory. You know what I mean? But here's the deal with the artists. Is that for a long time, and I'm talking about illustrators, for a long time, illustrators have, first of all, there's not really a huge market to hire them. They get hired to do like what you do, which is, in my opinion, like the at least up until recently, the most lucrative direction, doing the commercial art and stuff like that. That is the most lucrative way to go. But guys that do like paintings and illustrations and everything, you either do comic books, you do posters, or you do like book covers. So you are completely reliant upon, you know, guys like me that publish books. I have, like I said, I've worked with a lot of artists. It is very rare to find an artist that respects deadlines, that works within the confines of the criteria that you need, and that charges you fair wages or charges you a fair amount. I've been stolen from. I've had, like, this last Bizarchives 4 was like 5 months late because I had an artist that just like ran off with my money. I had an artist that like didn't get it done and then popped up with the art like 2 weeks after deadline, saying that he had personal issues. Like, it was like, it was a complete nightmare. It was like herding cats. And like, anytime I kind of reach out and this is like what we have to deal with artists a lot. So this AI art is going to light a fire under their butt cheeks, right? You guys can't be doing this kind of stuff. And I'm not saying that all artists out there do this. You know, shout out, you know, the artists that I work with are Tariq Cavella, Don Kent, artist of Albion. I have Brendan Hurd. There's so many artists that I work with that are the best, right? I would suggest them to anybody, right? But this is the kind of stuff that, you know, I had this experience with musicians too, right? Musicians, I'd stop playing music because I couldn't find guys in the band that would show up on time, that didn't have drinking problems, that would rehearse and practice. It's like these for too long, we have been hearing this thing that, oh, well, art is this special esoteric thing, and you make art for yourself. It's not something that you shouldn't use it to make money. And because of that, they don't have the business sense. So now you have these artists that like don't respect the business side of everything, and they now have to compete with machines. So a lot of these guys that are out there that aren't very good or don't respect deadlines, that aren't professional, are going to have to deal with that. Whereas the guys out there that take it seriously are always going to get work, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And, you know, that just makes me think that we are in a war against the Mechanurge. And if we are the champions of authenticity, then, you know, we need to defeat insincerity, you know, and in doing that, not just by creating better art, but by being more organized and more efficient and more practical in how we do it. You know, like you said, if we want authentic artists to win out against artificial art, AI art, then those authentic, genuine artists need to up their game. They need to start behaving in a more, I don't know, a more kind of pragmatic, a more, they need to take more responsibility, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and this goes across the board for everybody. Yeah. You know, not just illustrators, but, you know, people that make music, people that make, if we really love art, and we want to protect art and keep it authentic and keep it human, we have to professionalize. We have to work together. We have to promote these things, and we have to it has to be lucrative. You know, here is the reality of modernity. If we don't make dollars, it don't make sense. If what you're doing doesn't put food on the table for your kids, you're not going to be able to put more time into it. If you can't put more time into it, you can't get better at it. We got to get serious about what we're doing. And it's going to, this is just the way that it is, right? And I'm not saying that these are good things. I'm not advocating for them. But throughout all of history, since the first guy sharpened the first stick, everybody that had some sort of craft or trade had to, when new technology came out, had to become more clever, right? So we have to become more clever to try to survive. But I also think that, there will be a very large, strong niche. I think in this wave of digital and mechanical art, there, whether it's AI music or AI art, AI illustration or AI writing, people are going to go out searching for authentic art in a way that they haven't in a long, long time. And I think that we have a huge opportunity to capitalize on that.
Yeah, well, I've got something to say on that. You know, the Woodlander, who's another guy, great guy, that's been a guest on the Fergan podcast, he left a comment in under a Telegram post in the Fergan channel recently, saying that something along the lines of, the future will consist of the search for authenticity. Mm-hmm. I think that very succinctly puts the nature of our struggle to an extent. You know, I mean, there's two ways you can look at it. You can either be a champion of authenticity, you know, in a stubborn, dogged fashion, or you can kind of go with the flow and make the most of these kind of tools that have been handed to us by the enemy, or you can kind of do a mixture of both. But, you know, as someone who's been a music fanatic for a long time, there are bands out there who still insist on recording analog. You know, they record their records by analog. You know, they don't use any digital recording. They don't use computers. They record onto, like, you know, quarter inch tape or whatever, or you know, eight tracks and stuff like that. And I grew up with one of those as well. My father was in the music industry, the audio industry, and he got me and my brothers like a Tascam quarter inch reel to reel recorder and stuff like that. So I kind of learned to do stuff on that, and man, it's so much more effort than, you know, just getting on a computer and turning on like GarageBand or Pro Tools or whatever most people use these days. But the point is that there are people who, despite the extra hardship and the flaws of using those techniques, they still insist on doing it. Just like there are bands out there who will not use autotune. They refuse to use autotune, even if in places the vocals are going to sound a bit off, you know. Also, there's been this huge rise in recent years and over the last decade or two in vinyl collectors, you know, people who are insisting on collecting, you know. And that's a reaction to like the whole, you know, streaming Spotify, Deezer world. So I agree with you. There will be a reaction against this stuff.
I'm one of them. I got my vinyl player sitting behind me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the problem is that, you have to, as long as you realize that by being someone who is going to fight that corner, you are taking the hard road. You know, you're going to have less convenience. It's going to be more expensive. Not many people are going to appreciate it, you know, because there are very few people who are that stubborn about this kind of stuff. But just like myself and my refusal to have a smartphone, it's more of a personal thing. You know, you can look at yourself in the mirror and say, okay, I stood by that conviction, even if it made my life more difficult. I stood by that conviction, you know? So there's nothing wrong with either way, really. You know, you can kind of make use of these tools if you're comfortable, like spiritually doing that, or you can make a stand. And, you know, if you make a stand, it's probably going to only be for your own benefit. No one's going to appreciate you for it, or very, very few people are.
Yeah. We have to understand that. So when we look at things, like you mentioned, I believe we talked about this in one of your chats one time, that masculine, like, for example, there's this big thing, return to masculinity, right? We got to make men more masculine and et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, we do need to make men more masculine. Testosterone in men has dropped drastically. It's been this collapse of testosterone. And there's so many great guys out there talking about men's health and promoting things like going to the gym and doing MMA and eating eggs. You know, shout out Raw Egg Nationalist. I love his book, by the way. Lots of great stuff like that. However, we do have to realize, and this is, you know, what I'm saying is that we have to realize that this return to masculinity is a simulation, right? We are simulating this masculinity because we've been left with this hole in our being, in this hole. The bottom line is masculinity is obsolete in technological society. Why? What, you go to the gym and you work out so you can just aesthetically look strong, aesthetically look violent, aesthetically look like you're dangerous, right? It's an aesthetics thing. It's an aesthetics thing. It's a health thing, so you feel better, and it's a spiritual thing. But the bottom line is that that level of masculinity no longer has purpose. Where and when are you going to wield your superior strength? Where and when are you going to have the opportunity to wield this violence without it being a threat to your fundamental reproductive and economic interests? Nowhere. If somebody hits on your girlfriend and you beat the crap out of him and you split his skull open, you are now going to jail. You know what I mean? If somebody breaks into your home, in some countries, and, you know, luckily I live in a place where we have castle laws and stuff still. But if somebody breaks into your home, you blow his head off, you shoot him, you're going to jail, right? Luckily, like I said, in my state still, if somebody breaks into my home, I can kill that sumbitch and I'll be fine, right? They'll take me to, there'll be a trial, et cetera, et cetera. But I will, the state laws protect me with that. But it's only a matter of time before that changes. The bottom line is that masculinity, the way that we go about emulating or simulating it, is because it is obsolete and doesn't really have purpose anymore in this modern age, besides it makes us look and feel good.
Yeah, so Ted Kaczynski called that surrogate activity.
Yeah, surrogate activity, that's right. But here's the deal, is that a surrogate activity, these simulations, although they may be simulations, they're still meaningful to us and they're still good for us. You know what I mean? Like just going to the gym, I feel like a boss when I go to the gym. You know what I mean? And that's, you know, we got to realize that, yeah, it's a simulation, but it's still good for us and we should still do it. You know what I mean? There's no reason, like the whole argument of like simulated reality, right? I know that there's a bunch of the I love science people are like, well, we'll simulated reality, which I don't think is real at all. But let's say this reality is simulated. What is the end result, the end argument of if reality is simulated? If reality is simulated, you still got to go with it because according to our perception, it's still real, right? Doesn't matter if you know, what happens in your life is a simulation or not, it still feels real. You still perceive it as real. So you might as well act as though it is real. So it doesn't even matter. So that's what we need to do, right? It kind of goes against everything that I just said, all the doomsaying that I just said. But the bottom line is that regardless of what is going to happen, regardless of the situation of everything, I think that we need to take off the rose-colored glasses of let's return to you know, being medieval farmers, and understand that, you know, we're on a fast track to a technological future, but how we behave in that technological future, it really, really matters. And I think that in as the Mechanurge grows, we might not be able to overthrow it. However, we may be able to influence the way that we behave, right? So I don't know.
Yeah, you said earlier in the conversation that, you know, you think that the last few decades or generations, I can't remember which, have been born into this kind of Mechanurge, you know, artificial, you know, society, this kind of technosphere. I would say that in many cases, surrogate activities actually represents the last link we have to humanity, you know, because even if it is futile, you know, even if going to the gym is in a sense futile and it is a surrogate activity, the point is that our will to put ourselves through that hardship of, you know, going, you know, the pain of, like, you know, lifting heavy weights or whatever, or of, like, you know, being a long distance runner who's, you know, just run like 20 miles in an hour or whatever, you know, and you mm-hmm. go through that immense struggle. The fact that we still want to do that, even though it serves no real practical purpose in modern society, I would say is it still represents that kind of spark of humanity. And at this point in time, I would say that that's the most important thing to hold on to, because whilst we still have that, whilst we still have this drive to put ourselves in situations which could be far more comfortable, far more convenient, far easier, more lucrative, you know, whatever, yet we still choose the authentic, we still choose the hardship, we still choose that hard road and that struggle over those things, that's what keeps us human, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that with the way that we're going, we have a huge opportunity to go in a direction that is really good, you know what I mean? It's like you mentioned about vinyls. I'm an audiophile. I love vinyls. You know, I have cassettes sitting on my desk right here. I love cassettes because they have this texture to them. They have that thin hiss of the sound. Yeah. And it's just awesome to me. I don't know why. It just sounds so much better. It's an authentic listening experience, right? And when we put on a vinyl, like, for example, one of my favorite albums, and Dan, I know being a British guy, you probably are familiar with this album. One of my favorite albums is Machine Head from Deep Purple. Mm-hmm. I fucking love this album. It's one of my, like, Desert Island albums, right? If you sent me, I could listen to this album for the rest of time. I put this album on vinyl. Now, I got my vinyl player hooked up, like, yeah, I guess a year ago or something like that. And I'm starting to collect my vinyls again. I put Machine Head on. There are, like, tom hits and, like, rim strikes and like little, like, you could hear, like, the Blackmore's pick hitting the strings, and you hear things in the, it's like hearing the song for the first time again, like the band's in the room with you. And this experience cannot be produced by technological society. The technosphere can't give me this experience. It can't give me this experience with anything else. So are we trapped in this hyper reality? Are we trapped in the technosphere and genetically we can't escape? Maybe. But while we're here, we could do some stuff that our ancestors wouldn't have been able to do in recent times, right? We are very soon coming into a time of post-scarcity where we're not going to, like, they'll be able to just make stuff, right? Well, we're going to be, like, they're working towards liberating us from labor with universal basic income and all this kind of stuff. And I'm saying, like, that's a train that's coming and we're not going to be able to dodge out of the way of. However, we might be able to use it to our advantage and abuse it and have fun and, like, vandalize this place and abuse it. You know what I mean? We might be able to, this is my whole concept of hyper romanticism. You know, we are the fish that is in the fishbowl, that is inside of an aquarium that sits at the bottom of the ocean. And we might not be able to directly remember what it's like to swim in the ocean, but we have art forms and we have memories of that, right? That little bit of every time we listen to a vinyl, every time we hear a cassette tape, every time we pick up a book that's old school pulp fiction and we look at the very organic sketches that are in it and read the stories that are a little bit lumpy but are just exciting and weird, it's just like, it's like a little bit of that cool ocean water comes into our fishbowl, and we get these memories, this experience coming back to us. So I think that us as artists, as we go into this future that I described, that might be kind of bleak and dark and everything, it is, we are going to like have this opportunity to just like create in a way that we've never been able to before. And I'll be kind of honest, I'm sort of excited for it. I can't wait to see the weirdness and the creativity that comes out of people that are stuck in this shitty future. You know what I mean? So it's, I don't know, maybe it's a weird take to have that, but I don't know. I just, I think it's, I'm not even worried about it. You know, I know I dropped all those black pills, and there's more black pills that we could drop, but the bottom line is, we have a wonderful opportunity ahead of us. And, I think that the people that are really clever and that are really creative are going to be able to create things that are. And also, here's the thing with the Mecha Nerds. Technological Society is 100% foundationally held up by oil, right? We could be looking at a time very soon that we run out of oil. If we run out of oil, the technosphere is fucked. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. And, you know, whilst men and women still fall in love, and whilst still people still choose to go and watch live music rather than, you know, stream music on their device, you know, listen to just a guy or a girl with an acoustic guitar, or, you know, just singing and playing in front of a few people around a campfire, you know, that is beyond the reach of the Mecha Nerds. And whilst still people still choose those things over digital entertainment and, you know, the kind of digital interface to the world, humanity survives, and beauty and wonder and art survive as long as those things do. So I'm not pessimistic about it. You know, I think it's a really dark concept that we've outlined here, and I think it's something to kind of consider seriously, especially if you're kind of a naturally philosophical person. But I don't see any signs of humanity being completely snuffed out. You know, in it can seem a lot of the time like we're pretty close to it, but you know, there are still, you know, millions of loves, you know, like love relationships happening all over the world. Every moment someone falls in love, you know, that stuff that is outside of the realm of the Mecha Nerds.
Yeah, it while we still breathe, while our hearts still beat, while we still feel what we feel and think what we think and go about the human experience, the Mecha Nerds will never be able to take that away. You know, I mean, we will always strive and figure things out and do. I just, when I talk about this, you know, the technosphere as a whole, I present it because it's we need it like a shock to realize what is coming, because we have to look at it pragmatically. We have to understand that running away into the woods and creating a homestead, while it may be fun and it may be fulfilling and it may be healthy and all of these kinds of things, that is not a solution. Technological Society reaches so far out. They did a test. They dug up groundwater that is like out in the middle of nowhere, and they found traces of SSRIs, which are antidepressants, of birth control pills, of like these forever chemicals. That, you know what I mean? Like I mentioned, there's plastic at the bottom in the Mariana Trench. Like it's so far reaching that you can't run away from it. So what I say is maybe it's time to think about leaning into it and using it to our advantage to create a future where we, you know, realize ourselves in a way that we weren't able to. One of the things that I think of is maybe the Mecha Nerds is, although all this like rotten, bleak stuff is happening, it is reminding us about beauty. It's reminding us about our humanity. Because if you think about it, if you look about the technological levels that were happening between like, you know, the last 50 years or so, if we didn't come into this hyper reality, if we didn't come into the digital age, if we didn't have social media and the increasingly mundane, boring, vanilla, drab, sterile stuff that we're getting between, you know, Hollywood entertainment and our experiences on social media and our boring day jobs where we just click and computers do everything. If we didn't have that and we were stuck in that technological situation that we had in previous decades, maybe we wouldn't have snapped awake and said, this is boring. I want to experience true beauty. I want to experience true music. I want to experience true art. I want to experience humanity. I want to leave my house and go meet like-minded people. I want, if that would have kept going on and on and on and on, maybe we would have never snapped awake. So maybe we're headed to a dark enlightenment of sorts.
Yeah, it's like that old saying, you don't know what you got until it's gone. And having a spotlight shone on what you're losing can make you realize how much you adore that thing that's disappearing. So, yeah, I mean, there were a couple of things I wanted to bring into this conversation, but it, I mean, they seem kind of surplus to the conversation at this
point. Let's hear it now. What is it?
Well, I was just going to say, I was going to ask you what you think about this idea that technology has always been deemed an evil. I think back to the William Blake poem, which is became the song. I believe it became the hymn Jerusalem, and one of the lines in that is, "And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills?" And it's generally accepted that what he was referring to there is the idea that post-industrial England, the industries, the mills, the factories of England were evil by their very presence. And I can't help wonder whether, philosophers like William Blake, saw what was coming down the line. They saw what would happen to humanity if humans were plucked from their kind of natural state of being, thrust into these industrial hellscapes and stuff. So, yeah, what do you think about that? Do you think that, in a sense, we can say that technology... evil's the wrong word, because as you said, it has its uses and there is a good case to be made for using technology. And obviously we're using technology right now to have this conversation and for people to hear it. But would the world have been a better place had the Industrial Revolution never taken place?
So I try to separate myself. I try not to moralize everything. I kind of, because when you moralize things too much, you kind of get a little bit miserable when you come to certain conclusions where there is no solution, right? Like when if you moralize technology, you get, we have to destroy everything. And it's like, you can't. And then when you realize that you kind of can't, or that you're powerless against it, that is just like, that just wrecks you. You know what I mean? So I try not to moralize. I try to accept things like pragmatically. This is how it is, whether I like it or not. How do we move forward? How do we work with it? You know what I mean? So when it comes to technology, was it always evil? Now let's use evil in the context of in a heathen context. What does evil mean? Evil comes from the Saxon word "evil," which means like in excess or over the line, or it would be cognate to something like adharmic, something that is in opposition to dharma or erlog, something that is out of order. So when did technology knock us out of order? When did technology become evil? Some people would argue that the first piece of technology was evil. Some people would argue that language as a technology was when it changed us. Some people argue that when we started to apply names to things around us, we gave names to things at that. Now, I think that those things are ridiculous. I think that the aspects of phenomenology where we name things and apply language and meaning and all these things to our surroundings, without that we would just be like retarded, right? But when did technology knock us out of order? It's really hard to pinpoint. I don't want to pinpoint, but you could argue that the Mechanurge was born the moment that the first tool was created. You know what I mean? From that point on, it was going. Or you could say that when the first simple machines were made, the wedge, the pulley, et cetera, the lever, when these things were created. And then you could go forward and say when steel or concrete was created, or when the first transistor was created, right? The steam engine. It's hard to pinpoint where it became evil, but at some point there, at some point in the timeline, we hopped onto the slippery slope.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. We would need to define technology before kind of passing any kind of judgment on it. Mm-hmm. And I wrote some notes a few years ago, actually, and I've not done anything with them, but I wrote some notes about how I would consider unnecessary technology anything which fulfills a function which can already be performed in a more natural manner. For example, all these machines that we have, in the post-industrial society, like weaving machines, looms, electronic looms, mechanical looms, that was something that was previously done by hand. On the other hand, a knife, a blade, that doesn't replace an existing ability that we had. We didn't have the ability to cut things until we had the blade. So the blade is a necessary form of technology, whereas the internet is an unnecessary form of technology. I think you would need to distinguish the two camps from one another, but that's definitely a conversation for another episode.
I would say that definitely fits into it. You look at what people I would very much describe what people say is late stage capitalism as part of the mechanurgy in its systems. Late stage capitalism, what is late stage capitalism? Late stage capitalism is when capital or an industrialization begins to create new markets in order just to sell products for things that people don't need. Yeah. Right. It is this forever expansion. Now, some people would say, oh, that's part of Keynesianism. But it happens in other countries as well that never even heard of Mr. Keynes. Right. So it's like you could point to like Coca-Cola. Right. People didn't need Coca-Cola. People don't need designer shoes. People don't need video games. People don't need XYZ. But now it's getting increasingly more ridiculous with what they sell people. It's like the same thing with drug dealers, right? People say there's this goofy thing, which I disagree with completely, that if you have if your community gets hit with drugs and you go around beating up drug dealers, well, then they're just going to get replaced. It's the drugs, it's the demand, et cetera, et cetera. That's not true. The drug dealer comes and creates a market. He creates a market by giving people drugs and getting them hooked on it. So he can sell more drugs. This is the same exact thing of late stage capitalism, and this is the way the mechanurge works. The same thing with, like, for example, commercial fishing. Commercial fishing, they begin to when they started to for example, in the North Atlantic, fishing boats started to fish, and they started to see depletion of the populations of fish. What did they do? They didn't figure out ways to create more. Now, a thinking moral person would be like, okay, well, we need to get these populations of fish bigger. Well, it goes against human reason and human morality. And what people did was they created more efficient fishing vessels with deeper reaching nets, et cetera, so they could further fish the already depleted fish populations. This is like how the mechanurge works. Machines do not have the capacity to think of morality or to think of the effects of what is going on. They can only adapt and make themselves more efficient. The mechanurge has made humanity, made human beings, has mechanized their minds so that they would think in this manner, right? So it fulfills the will of the mechanurge to forever expand, to forever replicate itself, and to forever keep going. This is late stage capitalism. This is why, like, late stage capitalism isn't even really capitalism anymore. It's like this. People say it's technocracy, it's XYZ. I say that it is the mechanurge. So I forget where we started, but
I agree. I was just, we were just talking about, how we define technology. And I've actually just dug out the notes. I wrote these notes when I was on tour around Europe in February 2020, just before COVID dropped. And I was touring, playing some shows around Europe, and I wrote these notes in the back of a car. I'm just going to give a few of the examples. Sure. I put things like, we created roads when we had rivers, and obviously all of these things can be argued, but I was just trying to come up with examples of what I called facsimile technologies, you know, technologies which served a pre-existing function, but in a more convenient way. You know, we created the computer to replace the processing of the human brain. We had, instead of herbal medicines, we created drugs. You know, instead of community, we had social media. Instead of wood, we had plastic. Instead of sex, we have pornography. You know, instead of legs, we have bicycles. You know, things like that. And like, the reason I say that this is a discussion for another time is because it's a huge discussion, and you could really get into the fine details of all of that stuff and take it point by point and say, well, no, that technology isn't a facsimile technology. It's a legitimate one that we need because of this, and there'd be all kinds of debates and arguments about it. But yeah, the point is that you're right. We would need to define technology before we can pass any kind of judgment on it. And yeah, late stage capitalism is it's an abomination, frankly.
Yeah. It's there's this argument that and also Dr. B, I can never say his name right. That was at Pagan Futures. He made this, yeah, I can't say his name right. I'm sorry. I'm American, but I just call him Dr. B. So Dr. Yeah. B, well, I like him. I think he's a very smart guy, and I really enjoy his talks. I very much disagreed with his presentation, because he comes from this school of thought where he thinks that everything starts with an idea. Right. That was, and he just describes everything as this imminent frame. And in my opinion, this is a false dichotomy created by transcendentalists. I don't recognize transcendentalism as a thing. I think everything is imminent. But in his thing, he says starts with an idea. Now, this can happen in certain places where there's like political upheavals. Obviously, you could say that Enlightenment philosophy is a thing. But I would argue that Enlightenment philosophy was influenced by agricultural technology, right? You could argue that I pretty much argue that most of human progress, human transformations in societies were because of technological advancements, right? Whether it be war, whether it be society, whether it be et cetera, et cetera. You know, for example, feminism, right? We look at feminism as effectively just a mind virus disease that everywhere it takes hold in any society, anywhere throughout history, even like things like proto-feminism that we can identify in places like ancient Rome, birth rates collapse. It's like it's literally just a disease that sterilizes a society. It's horrible, right? But what creates feminism? Feminism is created when there's too much decadence and there's not enough male workers, and industrialization expands and they need to double their workforce. Feminism, especially in the West, is a result of technological influence. They needed more workers. So they created feminism. Feminism was born out of that in order to send women into factories.
Yeah, it wasn't an idea that was created in a vacuum.
It wasn't just some guy didn't just cook it up. I don't ascribe to that school of thought.
No, I agree with you for sure. So yeah, in kind of wrapping up this conversation, you know, there's one thing I jotted down earlier where, you know, when you were first laying out the idea of the mechanurge, and it's kind of like, we could also look at it, and correct me if I'm, you know, misrepresenting what you said there, but what we call the natural order is like this positive blueprint that exists within the natural realm, the way that things should be, the law of physics, and the way that things are attracted to one another, the way that chemicals work with one another. And it kind of promotes growth, and it promotes life, basically. So we can kind of look at the mechanurge as the antithesis to that, as like almost like a negative blueprint that's kind of, you know, like shoulder barging its way in to kind of replace that positive blueprint. And it's kind of creating this force of atrophy almost. Is, you know, is that the kind of thing that you were trying to lay out there?
I would say that the mechanurge operates by the same blueprint.
Right.
It's operating as by the same blueprint, and it is here to effectively replace us. Right.
By the same blueprint as, you know, Orleg or Dharma.
Yeah, I would say that the Mechanurge technological society, the technosphere, if you will, whatever you want to call it, is operating according to the same principles that led to life itself and led to humanity.
Okay, right. Okay, right. Thank you for clearing that
up. It's just
up.
It's just bad for us. You know what I mean?
Okay. And the last thing I wanted to the last point I wanted to make, or the last question really, is how can we kind of relate this to the concept of Kali Yuga? Is the Mechanurge the kind of physical manifestation of the Kali Yuga?
I think it is. I think the Mechanurge is the like harbinger of the Wolf Age.
Right.
That's really, really what I believe. Because if you look at, you know, when you read Voluspa, what is it? It talks about it very much describes when it talks about, you know, we're going in a direction I wasn't ready for.
Yeah, but, no worries. We don't need to get deep into it.
So, long story short, I believe that what happens after the Mechanurge is at like full power, when the technosphere is at full power, is where we realize the Wolf Age. I think that is the Wolf Age. You know, it says, brother will attack brother, father attacks son, heart is on earth with mighty whoredom. And then all the world falls headlong. This is describing the previous mode of humanity, right? This is not just all of reality. This is man's reality and how we interact with our natural order and everything like that. And it is going to rewrite what it means to be human, or at least it's going to try. And do I think that it's going to come to fruition? I think it's going to come to fruition. I think that I don't know. I don't want to say what the conclusion is, because it's like the blackest of pills. So
yeah, let's not go there. I mean, for myself, I think that it will emerge to a much greater degree than it currently has done. But as I said earlier, you know, as long as people are still falling in love, as long as people are still choosing to go and listen to someone play music acoustically, as long as people are choosing hardship just for the sake of hardship, even, and they're choosing inconvenience over convenience, then to me, that represents the living human spirit that has not been the indomitable human spirit that has not yet been snuffed out. So, I'll only start to become pessimistic when I see signs that those things that I've just described are truly dying away universally.
Yeah. And also, like, the way I look at it is, regardless of what's coming, when my time's over, when I leave this world, and, you know, it's very clear that we will face our doom. Humanity will face its doom someday. And it probably won't be in our lifetime, probably gonna be thousands of years from now. And the road might be tough. There's going to be golden ages and dark ages and these ages. And it's just going to go on and on and on and on until we do inevitably one day reach our doom. But I do. You know, I have faith. I have faith in the high holy gods, and I have faith that after I leave this world, that I will be with them, and I will be with my ancestors. And in that, I find comfort. And what I'm worried about in this time, despite all the black bills and bleakness that we talked about here, when life itself is a gift and is a beautiful gift, and when it's over, we will go to the next world and we will be with our loved ones and be with, you know, our holy sires and the holy golden, and till it's time to be reborn again and continue the struggle. So, you know, that's the way that I see it. I just have faith. You know, that's my end argument.
Yeah. And ultimately what matters is that, you know, if you're a heathen or a pagan, what matters is that you can face your gods and your ancestors in the knowledge that you lived nobly, that you lived honorably, and that you did everything you could to uphold Orlag or Dharma or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, if you're a Christian, that you can look your savior in the eyes and say that you did the same, you know. So that's why a spiritual worldview is so powerful, because whatever material fate may, you know, be may await us, as long as we hold on to that kind of spirit of divinity, then we're good.
Yep, we're good. I have faith.
Yeah, man. Well, thank you so much, Dave, for talking us through that concept, and hopefully people found it interesting and fascinating and not too black-pilling, not too terrifying, because it is pretty dark, but it really fascinates me, and I'm glad that you took some time to help us understand it, because it's good stuff, man. So thank you as always for talking with me, Dave.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I hope I did a good job explaining it, because it is kind of like a really big weird concept, and it took me a long time to kind of piece it together, and I hope that I'm wrong about it. I hope that I just made it up and I'm wrong, and that's it. Yeah, so but I hope I did a good job explaining it, and I hope there are some white pills in there for folks. And Mr. Dan, thank you so much for having me, and blessings and hails to everybody out there, and I'll see you guys next time.
Yeah, and just if you could just remind everyone where they can find his stuff as well.
Oh yeah, if you guys want to check out some weird fiction, man, we got so many great books for sale. Go over to the bizarrechives.com and go buy some books. We got lots of good stuff. Bizarrechives 1, 2, 3, 4. We got Algernon Blackwood, Masters of Horror. We got the Malignus Articulate. We have Sacred Times Part 1. So if you like fantasy, science fiction, cosmic horror, all of that great stuff, sword and sorcery, we got you covered for books that are like all in around $10 and less. So go over to the bizarrechives.com, pick us up on Amazon, Waterstone, or whatever book retailer near you, and support folk economy and buy books.
Nice. Yeah, really quick question, Dave. Have you ever thought about writing a short story or series for the Bizarrechives that centers around this concept of the Mechanurge?
I have it in there already. It's
okay,
not in its totality, but I do have certain elements of it in some of my stories.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm behind. I need to catch up on that. And so thank you, Dave. And those of you who don't know, I'm a musician. You can check out my music with Walkensman. I wrote a short story as well called Fire in the White Stone, which might interest some of you. I just released an audiobook version of that. And if you go to Fergen.com, Fyregen.com, not Frygen, it's Fergen, it's an old English word. There's like merchandise and stuff and information about how you can help support this podcast. So I'm sure we'll be speaking with Dave again in the future. Thank you, Dave, and thank you everyone for listening. Well, that was a pretty dark topic to get into, and I hope it didn't, I don't know, black pill or depress you guys too much. I should say that in trying to create or find a good podcast image for this episode, a good thumbnail, I did try to use AI art because I thought it would be kind of fitting to generate some AI art for the image for this episode. And I used a few different AI art generators, and I really couldn't get anything good out of any of them. I mean, I wasn't looking for a work of genius out of them, but I couldn't get anything which even remotely came close to kind of, depicting or expressing this Mechanurge concept in all of its horrors. And make of that what you will. I guess AI art still has a way to go, but we all know how quickly these things develop and improve. And, it may be that the very best AI art generators are kind of still behind closed doors and haven't been released to the public yet. So yeah. Anyway, to end this episode, we'll go to the riddle. So every episode we read from the Exeter Riddle book, and I give you all the this week's riddle, this podcast riddle, and in the following episode I give you the answer to the previous episode's riddle. So the last one was number 24, and that was quite a short one. I'm a strange creature with various voices. I can bark like a dog, bleat like a goat. The battle birds cry, the vultures croak, trips of my tongue and the mew of the seagull. I mean, my guess with that one was, obviously we don't have parrots in Britain, in the British Isles. But as I understand it, the corvid family of birds, not COVID, but corvid family of birds. So the raven, the rook, the crow, I think the magpie is a corvid. I think they have a similar ability to kind of mimic other noises. So looking at the answer to that one, and according to the book, it is accepted to be jay or magpie. So I guess I'm kind of right. But this is an interesting one because there is a runic element to this one, like a previous riddle we did. So I'll just read out the answer here. The runes in this riddle read G, A, R, O, H, and I. This is an anagram of Higora, or Higor, which is the feminine form of Higora, jay or magpie. These lines abound with onomatopoeia. The dog Beok barks, the goat bleats, the goose Grada honks, and the hawk Giela, pronounced Yella, shrieks. So, yeah, that's pretty fascinating, the way that the runes in that one are kind of hidden amongst the lines. I'll just read those lines that include the runes. G, which would be Gifu, suggests my name. And A, ask. R, Rad. And O, Os, assisted. And so do H, Hail. And I, Ice. So yeah, it's definitely as a heathen. Obviously, it fascinates me when runes are included in these old riddles because these riddles would have been written down in a post-Christian era. Yet the remnants of the pre-Christian era, such as runes and other aspects of folklore and belief, were still nevertheless hidden within the riddles. So the next riddle number 25. Here we go. I'm a strange creature, for I satisfy women, a service to the neighbours. No one suffers at my hands except for my slayer. I grow very tall, erect in a bed. I'm hairy underneath. From time to time, a beautiful girl, the brave daughter of some churl, dares to hold me, grips my russet skin, robs me of my head, and puts me in the pantry. At once that girl with plaited hair who has confined me remembers our meeting. Her eye moistens. that one's suggestive, to say the least. So, yeah, I'm not going to skip ahead and confirm what the answer to that one is, but I think we can probably all guess. So anyway, yeah, I'll reveal that in the next episode of the Fergan podcast. And yeah, as always, I thank you all for listening. Please check out the merchandise on fergen.com, fyrgen.com. Please consider being a patron, Subscribestar, Patreon, Substack. It helps me to continue doing this, and the only reason I'm able to make it free, you know, if you are listening for free, I can only do that because of those who are kindly contributing a bit of money towards this. I don't want to put it behind a paywall. So I am deeply grateful to those of you who voluntarily do support this podcast. And if you don't want to offer a monthly, you know, it's only $5 a month. You know, it's hardly anything. If you don't want to offer that, then, you know, buy a shirt or a hoodie. It's really good quality stuff for really good prices. It's all screen printed, not digitally printed. Really high quality stuff. Alternatively, if you have cryptocurrency that you can spare, there are Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Monero addresses on the website. You could consider throwing a few my way. Other than that, you could support me with my music on Bandcamp. You go to Wolkensmen, wolkensmen.bandcamp.com. You can find my music on there, and I've just released an audiobook version of my short story Fire in the White Stone, which those of you who are interested in paganism, mysticism, folklore, who are fans of Tolkien or Brian Bates's work, it's heavily inspired by that stuff. The story incorporates an enormous amount of esoteric symbolism, and I think that you'd get a lot out of it. Give it a go. It's only €5 to download that, and it includes snippets of music which I wrote to accompany it, So a lot of work went into it and I narrated it myself. So anyway, thank you all very much for listening, for sharing this, and I will speak to you in the next episode.